Howdy, I'm Rachel Acosta.
And I'm Justice Tirapelli Jamail.
And this is Friends on Film.
And other creative mischief.
We're so excited about the reopening of the historic River Oaks Theater.
I can barely contain it.
And we have so much planned. We're so excited to share.
Every month, we'll bring you engaging interviews with filmmakers, historians, experts, and enthusiasts, and the people who keep art house theaters alive across the globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
And now, a conversation with our friends, Justice and Kyle McLaughlin.
Welcome, everybody, to Friends on Film. We are here with Kyle McLaughlin, a man who I believe needs no introduction, but on the basis of everything that he's accomplished, he is an actor from such films as Dune, Blue Velvet, shows like Twin Peaks, Vinter with Pursued by Bear, a podcaster with the show Varnum Town, which I've listened to and would hate to spoil anything, but can say that it's at least a little bit about how REO Speedwagon's plane, Pablo Escobar, and the town of Varnum Town all come together in a way that changes this very small town forever.
That's a wonderful description. I have to remember that. I like those three together. REO Speedwagon, Pablo Escobar, and Varnum Town. What do they have in common?
What do they have in common? Oh, and a man who wants nothing more than just to be a professional fisherman.
Oh, it's a sadder story.
It's a fascinating show. I'm curious. In the first episode, you talk about who you learned about this story from initially. Is, I believe, a friend of yours who is a soap tycoon?
Yes, Lynn Betts. I called her tycoon. She owned an organic, a very successful organic soap company in Pennsylvania, and she retired, sold her company, and moved to Varnum Town to retire with her husband. And while she was there, she met a man named Dale Varnum, who everybody knows him in Varnum Town. And Lynn met him, and he had a location where he was living called Fort Apache, which he had turned into a kind of a, I don't know, a giant labyrinth of backlot movie memorabilia. And it was from her that I heard the story initially.
And I'm curious, where did you and this soap tycoon, Lynn, meet?
She was actually, when she did the deal with her company, she worked with a fellow who my wife has a venture firm with. They are co-partners in this. And so it was through this gentleman named Nir who said to my wife, there's a very interesting story. I don't know if you think so too, but why don't you tell your husband and see what he thinks? And so I listened to the story. So it was from Lynn to Nir to my wife to me. And I was captivated, but I didn't really know how to turn this, what at the time I thought was a tall tale, into something that would be interesting to people. Was it a book? Was it a TV show? Was it a movie? I didn't know. And podcasts still hadn't quite come into the forefront yet. But when they did, I realized this would actually be the perfect story, because you could actually hear from the people themselves and listen to those rich North Carolina accents and feel like you were there in the place. And that made sense to me.
Listening to it, it definitely feels like you are there. How much of it were you there for before you decided this is definitely a story?
We were there, actually. We were there. I went down with a dear friend, an investigative journalist. So this is right in his wheelhouse. We went down together for about 6 days in Varnum Town with a small crew, and we recorded as many people as we could. We interviewed a number of different people that were involved in this crazy story: drug smuggling, Pablo Escobar, REO Speedwagon, local law enforcement, and many of the citizens of Varnum Town. And they all come together in this wild tale of smuggling, drug running, huge quantities beyond what anyone knew, like Miami equivalent quantities coming through this little town of 300 people.
Again, I don't want to spoil anything about the story because it's just, there are many twists and turns and it just takes such a journey. After all of this, is Varnum Town a place that you see yourself going back to very frequently? Do you feel like this was so big for you, just knowing everything about it, that it's maybe you feel like you have seen enough of Varnum Town? Or...
it's a really quaint, charming little place and off the beaten track, too. It's about an hour south of Wilmington in North Carolina. on the little coastal waterways that are down there, which makes it ideal, of course, if you're trying to bring something in or take something out without it being seen. But I did tell you this, that North Carolina has figured pretty prominently in my career. I first went there in the late 70s as an apprentice to a theater that was in Western North Carolina, not too far from Asheville, called the Flat Rock Playhouse. And I was there for two seasons, 78 and 79. And that really started me on my professional career, working on the main stage there. I returned to North Carolina to shoot Blue Velvet, which was in 1985, right about the same time that all the activities were happening in Varnamtown, in fact. I then went back to North Carolina and did a play at Playmakers Rep at UNC, Chapel Hill, and then went back to Varnamtown to do this podcast. So I don't know what's going on with me in North Carolina, but I keep going back there. I should just move there for work, I think.
Well, it seems as though you continue to.
Almost, yeah.
At the time, so while you're there and this is all happening, there was no sort of murmur of all of this going on in Varnamtown?
So funny, it was so tucked away. I mean, granted, we were about an hour away. We were really focused on what we were doing, but not a clue of what was happening down there at that time. And the story takes place in the late 70s, 80s, into the 90s, and with a variety of different types of contraband that came through. So initially starting with bales of marijuana, like freighters full of marijuana, and then being both flown in and shipped up from South America, and then moved to cocaine and Quaaludes, which was a drug that was coming in quite heavily in the 80s and 90s. And yeah, and so had a makeshift airstrip where the plane that you mentioned, the REO Speedwagon tour plane, was making stops. Nothing to do with REO Speedwagon, apart from the fact that the logo of the band was still on the plane that they were using to bring these shipments in, which I thought was pretty funny. Being a fan of the band myself back in the day, because that is my generation. So it was fun to learn that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting way for someone to have nothing to do with something so insane is to have their name right there.
I'm sure they were unaware. I hope they were.
Pretty good advertising for a rock band, too.
Yeah. It's a great cover when you think about it. It's like, hey, REO Speedwagon's coming to town. Better than having Pablo Escobar put his logo on the side of the plane, which would be a tip-off, of course.
It's a little obvious. Speaking of contraband, at least something that's far more legal, your wine company, Pursued by Bear. I'm very curious about a few things, if you don't mind talking about it a little bit.
It started as a kind of a lark. I thought it would be fun to make wine in my home state. I grew up in Yakima, Washington, which is Eastern Washington, which it resembles Texas more than the West Side, to be quite honest. It's a high desert. It's not green. It's not lush. There's no evergreen trees. It's all farming for the most part, a lot of wheat farming. So very little moisture. Lends itself really well to vinifera, the wine grapes, because it's all about the moisture and having enough heat, of course, which we have both, no moisture and lots of heat on that side of the mountains. And I grew up and I was aware of the wine business and I watched it grow. And I thought this was always something that I'm interested in. I love wine and I love the process. And I've got dear friends in Napa and I've been to Bordeaux. And I just thought it would be fun to try to make wine in Washington State and see what happens. And I couldn't do it without a partner. And quite by accident, I met a guy named Eric Dunham at Dunham Cellars. And Eric and I had a handshake deal. And I brought in 12 barrels initially that we used for my first vintage, which was in 2005. We made 300 cases, a tiny little production, and I was hooked. And from 2005, I'm still doing it. I went from one wine. I've got now seven, with six out. There's another one on the way, all from Eastern Washington, all different varietals. We're still a fairly small production, about 3,000 cases, 3,000 plus, but I'm heavily involved. I was just up in Seattle, actually, at an event called Taste Washington, which is kind of a giant arena where most of all the wineries are there represented and pouring for people in the trade and also consumers. And that was a fun 2 days of talking. That's why my voice, I think, is a little shot. I was there representing both days for about 5 hours of constant chatter, but really loved it and got such great feedback from the wine. And I'm actually in Texas. I've got a distribution company in Texas. They distribute through Dionysus is the name of the company. Michael Humphreys, who's one of the sales force there, is one of the reasons I'm on the Zoom with you.
Fantastic. I love knowing all that. And thank you to him. the name I'm curious about. I would love to know if this is true, but from what I read, the name came from Steve Martin, or as a recommendation from Steve Martin at a dinner that the two of y'all had. Is there any truth to that?
Truth, yeah. I'm so glad you got Steve Martin, because for so many years it was Fred Savage. And when things get on, who I don't know, but I'm very nice, I'm sure. But somehow when it gets into the digital print, it doesn't disappear very easily. But I finally set the record straight. And yeah, so I had been searching for a name and found in this process, so many of the ones that I wanted were already trademarked and not available. And I wanted something that could be associated with what I did as an actor. So I did a lot of Shakespeare when I was younger. And I thought, oh, something within the stage tradition would be really nice. I was thinking of things like stage left or downstage or upstage, this kind of thing. And I just popped into my head this wonderfully delicious stage direction from The Winter's Tale, which is not one of his more popular plays, but inside that play, he wrote the stage direction, Exit, Pursued by a Bear. And the conceit is that the bear actually comes on stage, chases the actor off the stage. And then we learn of his fate when the next group comes on, which sadly the bear was very hungry, so he didn't end up in a very good state. And I thought, oh, I love this Pursued by a Bear. I said, that's fun. And I immediately got an idea of a label, of course, which is a literal visual of what the play asks for. But I wasn't sure. And that evening, it just so happens, my wife and I were actually coming back from Napa, where we were visiting friends. And she had a dinner with Steve Martin, who she knew. And I was the extra. Went to Steve's house, and we sat and had a lovely dinner. He's also a wine drinker. And I got up the courage to get his opinion on this idea. And he thought it was a great idea. So that was a final okay that I needed to proceed with this name. And so happy that I did, because it's unusual. It did bring me into the bear world, which is, so all my wines have a bear reference, which was unexpected, but it's worked out.
And you're a bear enthusiast now?
I guess so. There is an organization that I'm looking at to support called Y2Y, which is Yellowstone to Yukon. And it's really focused on the migratory patterns of a grizzly bear and other animals between the Yukon Territory and the Yellowstone in Wyoming. And it's really a great organization trying to create a corridor to keep the gene pool diverse enough. And so I thought that would be a no-brainer to support that organization. So I'm looking at it right now. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, bear supporter now for sure.
Bear supporter. I like that. I'm curious, with that stage direction driving the name, can you remember any of your favorite pieces of stage direction that you've read in scripts of yours or plays that you've been in? Anything that really just caught your eye?
Nothing that is descriptive or as fantastical as that. That still is the number one. There were some things in Dune where they say things like, he climbs up the side of the giant sandworm. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not something you do every day. I've been fortunate enough to be in some pretty interesting films and television. But no, in terms of the play, that wins hands down.
It's hard to top.
Hard to top, yeah.
And while talking about just direction in general, High Flying Bird, that film, the film that you were in, that was filmed with iPhones entirely. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Steven Soderbergh directed that.
Yes. So I watched an interview with Nicolas Cage where he was talking about how the 16 millimeter camera really lets an actor sort of just roam freely. You don't have to act past this big piece of machinery, and it's easier to fall into the world that way. Did it feel that way when you were shooting with phones as opposed to these big cameras?
Yeah, once you got used to the idea that you were doing something, because when a camera is present, of course you feel this is a moment. You get used to it. It's part of the experience in the scene. It's almost like it's a character, I always think. So when that's removed, I found it very vulnerable to what was going on. And at the same time, I found it really wonderfully freeing. Pressure was off. There was any pressure there. So when I was doing the scene sitting and there was just a little iPhone camera sitting in the corner filming us, it was sort of an anticlimactic moment. Steven would set the cameras up and not much lighting, you know, and just get it positioned right. And then he'd turn it on and he'd just go, okay. And he'd walk away. You know, there was no clapboard. There was no action. There was no, okay, this is the moment. And so in a way it was like you could start when you wanted to start. You could be talking with someone and then just start doing the scene. It was much more relaxed, I thought. You could keep going. maybe do a little improv or move off the script a little bit. So I get what Nick was saying about the sense of freedom, and you didn't feel like you had to be contained. I get that.
Have you had any other experiences acting that have felt farther outside of, I suppose, what we all imagine when we think of filmmaking? Like you said, the clapboard, action, more structured. Have there been other films that in some way sort of strayed outside of that, felt more avant-garde to participate in?
I don't know if it's avant-garde, but when we did The Doors, I remember we were with Bob Richardson, he was a DP on that, and he had five cameras going, which was the first time in my experience that I had it. Even on Dune, we had one camera, maybe two, Blue Velvet, the same thing. But on The Doors, he had cameras everywhere, but you never saw them. Unless you were like doing a scene, it was right there. In all the concert sequences, there were cameras everywhere. And so you forgot they were there and you just stayed in the character. And that was interesting for the first time, just not trying to, usually I'm kind of like, where's the camera? So what do I know how to relate to? And this was like, nah, there's nothing to relate to. They're just going to capture what they capture. So just forget about it and play the piano.
Sort of similar to High Flying Bird, it sounds like.
Similar, very similar.
Speaking of Dune and Blue Velvet, you've done a very impressive amount of work with David Lynch. Fire Walk With Me, that film. I have a question from an amazing rapper, local Houstonian, Fat Tony, was curious about that film. He has a few questions about it, actually. He was wondering, that film, from what I understand, did very well in Japan. Japan responded quite enthusiastically to that film. How did you first hear about the reception that it got over there?
They really love David Lynch. So he's sort of revered all over the world, but particularly in Japan and also in France, as you can imagine. They love their cinephiles over there. But I went to visit, and the Japanese demonstrate their enthusiasm for something by actually dressing up as the characters or creating. I've got lots of fan art from Japanese fans that pertains to Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, of course. Twin Peaks was, I think, even a bigger deal in Japan. And yeah, they really embraced David. And of course, Blue Velvet was what happened much before social media. So there was, you have to actually, to get that experience, oh, we went there, I went there. And they were just extraordinary in their enthusiasm.
And what was your experience promoting the film in Japan like?
First of all, you were sort of jet lagged. The Sofia Coppola film with Bill Murray.
Lost in Translation.
Yeah, it's like that. You feel sort of in a different place somehow because of the jet lag. But they fill your days with a lot of activity. So lots of interviews, lots of appearances on, I don't know if I'd call them talk shows. They're like game slash talk slash participation shows, which now on social you can access, where there's a lot of loud talking and noises and audience laughter, and they're all speaking in Japanese and you have no idea what's going on and you're all a little bit of a haze anyway, and trying to just keep up and participate as best as you can without really any sense of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that's what I remember. That was one of my major takeaways from my whirlwind tours that they put together when you go promote something like that.
Any of those game shows stand out in your memory?
It was such a long time ago. I don't remember. I just know that there was a lot of, some there were activities and things, but I can't remember. It wasn't anything as dramatic as any kind of participation. I was mostly just there and they were sort of around me talking loudly and quickly and laughing and having fun. So I was trying to have fun too.
Sure. Lastly, about the film in Japan, what can you tell us about your experience shooting the Georgia coffee commercials in Japan?
Oh, that was fun. It was the first big campaign, I think, that I did. I did one for Subaru as well over there. But the Georgia coffee we shot in the LA area on the sets. And David was the director of the commercials. And they had me and a few of the characters from Twin Peaks, actually, that were part of this ensemble. And it was fun and different, but it was cool to step back into the suit as Dale Cooper. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, there's a small storyline, if I recall, over the course of a few commercials for Georgia Coffee, which obviously you were a great candidate.
Yeah, that was perfect for me with coffee. It's funny, I haven't had another coffee campaign. since that one. And I'm kind of curious. I wonder if there's any interest there, actually, because Dale Cooper, of course, was so in love with his coffee, as am I. I take it exactly the same way. It's black and black as midnight on a moonless night, I guess.
Recently, you've been very active on social media, on TikTok, Instagram, and I'm a pretty big fan of your videos. A lot of people are, I know. I'm wondering, do you have a favorite Lorde song?
Oh, Green Light's pretty good. I love that. She's just an extraordinary artist. And Royal, of course, is how I first heard of her, right? And then I dug down a little bit. And this idea of imitating her selfie post actually came from, I work with a couple of folks that are part of my wife's company in the media side of things. And they suggested this. And I said, that sounds like fun. And she responded in such a lovely way, recognizing, I think, that we were there paying homage to her and her artistry. So we had a back and forth little Instagram, you know, moment. It was really nice.
Have you all kept in touch since that?
Not since then, but there's been a couple of ideas about maybe doing some kind of a chat together or something, just putting us together and talking a little bit about what we do, but we'll see if it goes anywhere.
I think I can speak for a lot of people and say that would be phenomenal to see.
Well, she's pretty amazing.
You both are. So that question was actually posed by another member of Friends on Film, Rachel. And they were also curious as to whether or not you're touching on press junkets, things like that earlier in tours. Is there anything that you would love to talk about that you don't really get the chance to often? Or I guess questions that you haven't been asked?
I can't think of any. It runs the gamut pretty well. There's always work that I've done that I'm proud of, but doesn't necessarily have the same kind of attention or focus unless you're really a super fan. And sometimes those performances, you want to talk about how much fun it was or what the experience was. There's two things. I did a film in Prague, we shot in Prague, called The Trial, about the Kafka novel, and played Joseph K. And that was a kind of a wonderful experience. I shot that in the early 90s. And then I went back to Prague and I shot a series called Atlantic Crossing, where I played FDR, where I finally let my hair go white for good. And that was a return to Prague. So along 25 years later, and the city had transformed, and it was this, not that it was beautiful in 92, but there wasn't much infrastructure. And by 2016, 2017, it was a bustling, beautiful European city with lots of great restaurants. And needless to say, I had a lovely time. I'm kind of a foodie, so I was out and about a lot.
And to see it in both states, I'm sure, was quite a thing.
Yeah, just nice to see it vibrant. You know what I mean? The city was beautiful in 92, and there were buildings and the architecture, and it's just extraordinary. It survived World War II pretty much intact, but there was no joy. And the return in 2017, suddenly there was tourism and restaurants, and people were out, and it was jam-packed and crowded. And I was right there during the Christmas celebration and the winter celebrations, and it was really fun.
That sounds like progress.
Yeah, it was. I got to say, I think it was a great thing, actually.
With Varnum Town, has that given you sort of an itch to do more podcasts moving forward? Is it something that you think you'll wait for the next story? Have you found one already?
It's funny you ask. I do want to do more podcasts. I have a couple of ideas. One is something that I would do myself. It's kind of an entrepreneurial podcast. It relates to wine, second careers, or second hobbies, or second passions. So I'm working on that. And then I'm also, I'd like to do something else with Josh. I really like him. I thought we had really great chemistry on Varnum Town together. Finding the story is proving to be challenging, because Varnum Town was such a, I didn't realize this going into it, but it had so many elements that I think, first, it was an unknown story for the most part. It involved notorious leader of Pablo Escobar, of a cartel, infamous. And then it was populated by these lovely community people from Varnum Town who were all involved. Not every single person in Varnum Town was involved, but many were, who all had a perspective and a story and a point of view and a reason. And so it had all these different elements that really lent itself to this story. And it also wasn't like someone wasn't brutally murdered, and that's what set this off on a journey. That's not really the thing that gets me. It's more about the story and the community and what happened to these people and how did they deal with this sudden influx of cash, drugs, how did it affect them? And so finding something that, not that it has to be exactly that, but something that has a lot of different elements like that, that people don't know about is challenging. So we're looking.
That's a high bar, that's for sure.
Unexpected high bar. Yes, it did.
The two of you absolutely have a very natural chemistry together. Was that something that you found through working together, or did you click off the bat?
We found it through working together, but it was there in the beginning. Really, he understands this kind of approach. He works his company, Epic. I think their logline is finding unusual true stories and telling them, or trying to tell them. And this fit the bill perfectly. So he was ideal. And he, as an investigative journalist, he's used to being in situations where he's asking questions and tough questions and really trying to get to the heart of what went on. I was there just for watching him work and then trying to contribute every now and then, more of a touchy-feely question. How did this make you feel? Did you ever question, you know, how this might impact your family and stuff like that? But he was really after the hard, cold facts. And so together we found our relationship, which roles we were playing in this journey as we went on it. And that carried over into the actual commentary, much of which was done after, where we were just sat in a room and we kind of listened through the podcast. And then we would just comment on what we heard or make a note about something. So we became participants along with the audience of listening it and hearing it and asking hopefully similar questions.
And the questions that you were saying that you, it was more along the lines that you stuck to, they sound almost like questions that you might get asked by a director or something to sort of get into a more emotional space in the line of work that you do. Do you feel that any of the natural place you fell into came from your works on set, or did it feel totally separate?
I think it was an interest in that side of the people that were being interviewed, kind of a natural empathy or a desire to understand what was happening, how the decision came to be. So I felt like that would be what I could contribute to the questioning that we went through with these people. And we would sit in a room with them for a couple of hours, and they were very open to talking with us and sharing their story. And this is something that happened years ago, and many of them had experiences that I think they felt they wanted to not get off their chest necessarily, but at least talk to someone about. They felt like there hadn't been like a download of this experience so much. You know, it kind of had happened and then it went away and people left. Wow, what do I make of this? So this was their opportunity, I think.
It's a wild thing to have happened in the first place, but to have it happen and then for it to go by the wayside, I can't imagine what it would have been like for them not to have this outlet that the both of you provided. And in a way that truly, Josh's company is aptly named. It is an epic story that y'all have given us. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or to say while we have you?
I can't think of anything. I love when I come to Texas, though. It seems like I'm down in Houston a lot. In Austin, I was just there at South By, and I've got dear friends down there. So I don't know. I'll have to come by the theater when I'm back down. It'd be fun. I guess that's it. I don't know.
So we have two people on, so we're going to let Ed has his hand raised. So I'm going to unmute Ed.
Hey, Kyle. Hope you're doing well. I'm a big fan. Big fan especially of Twin Peaks. Such a great show. And was wondering if you had any stories or feedback on how it was filming on set. And I know it was shot a lot in your home state of Washington, and just the way it was shot was so dreamlike and majestic. So I'm curious as to how that whole experience was for you. Thanks.
Thank you. It was a surreal experience because I grew up an hour and a half from where we filmed. Between my hometown of Yakima and Seattle is where many of the locations were, Snoqualmie, North Bend, Bellevue, those areas. And it was amazing to go back and to work in my home, kind of my hometown, because I went to school in Seattle for 5 years. I had never, while I was there, visited the falls. I'd never been to Snoqualmie. I'd been through North Bend only because you had to drive through North Bend at that time to get between my hometown and Seattle. So it was like I was back in a place that I knew but didn't know at the same time. And it was kind of an amazing thing to be sort of the, because everyone else that was up there, no one was from the region unless they were local hires. So I was able to tell people where they should go, what they should. I was like a tour guide, actually, for everybody, or a travel guide, making my recommendations of, you know, what it was like to, what to do in Seattle and what to do in Bellevue. And I thoroughly loved the experience. It was quite a short experience the first time we were there. I think the pilot was 21 days of filming or 24 days of filming, something like that. When we returned 25 years later, then we spent more time there. And that was also just, I love it up in the Northwest. It's one of my favorite spots. And to be able to shoot and live in that community was very special.
Awesome. Thank you.
Appreciate Welcome, man. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And Kyle, thank you so much for joining us. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to have you and have had you. Yeah, and we'll see you at the movies.
I look forward to it. Well, I'll reach out to you when I come to town.
And now let's talk about Art House Revival with our friend at Vidiots and Eagle Theater.
Hi, I'm Margot Gerber, and I'm a 25-year veteran of Art House Theaters.
Maggie McKay, welcome to our podcast. Maggie is the executive director of the Vidiots Foundation, based in Los Angeles in an area called Highland Park. I am so excited to talk to you today because I am so in awe of what you've done over the years. You started as a video store, you had a foundation, and then you decided to go theatrical and finished your theater during the pandemic. Can you encapsulate all those many years for us and explain how all of this came about?
Yeah, I joined Vidiots in 2016, but it opened in 1985. Our founders, Patty and Kathy, opened Vidiots in the 80s because they saw a gap in the culture and were very keen on opening what was then a for-profit small business. They had tired of working in industries where they were both working for men all the time. They wanted to go out on their own, and video stores were definitely an untapped market, at least as far as independent offerings were concerned. They realized that there was this gap they could fill. They opened in 85 and, of course, were one of the most beloved, successful brick and mortar businesses in Los Angeles for over 30 years. By around 2012, they were the ones who transitioned to a nonprofit. They were watching as DVR was especially concerning and just looking at the revenue streams in the business model, they started to get nervous. They transitioned to a 501c3 nonprofit. But by 2015, it was pretty grim. Santa Monica had changed pretty radically in terms of who was living there and how much it costs to run a business there. And so by 2016, they'd brought in two very significant gifts, one from a wonderful neighbor named Dr. Leonard Lippman, and then another from Annapurna Pictures, which is helmed by Megan Ellison. Those two gifts kept Vidiots going for about another year, but the industry was changing so rapidly. And Patty and Kathy really needed an executive director and needed to find someone who could work with them on a vision. That ended up to be me, because the first time I walked into Vidiots, not just as a civilian, but as a potential captain, coworker, whatever you want to call me, I just realized it was flooded with the feeling that Patty and Kathy's legacy needed to be preserved, that Vidiots needed to stay accessible to the public. And I grew up in New York City and watched everything that I loved about New York pretty much go away. And I didn't want to see that in the city I've devoted the last 25 years to. And I was very passionate about it. But by 2017, it was not really feasible to raise money and expand programming in Santa Monica. So we closed, put everything into storage. And I and about three other people in our immediate circle thought, you can probably figure this out. Figuring it out took a lot longer and was a lot harder than I thought. But we rebuilt a business model. I worked with an MBA team. They helped me build a business plan. We rebuilt the board of directors with a lot of really amazing experts. We built an advisory council. we started looking for properties. And then in 2019, this beautiful movie theater, which ran from 1929 until the year 2000, appeared on the radar in the neighborhood that I happen to live in. And once we saw that for lease sign up, we thought, this is it. And then, of course, we signed a lease and then a pandemic hit. That's the background.
The Eagle Theater, which is that the original name of the theater?
The original name was the Yosemite. And then in the 30s, they changed it to the Eagle. And that theater just jammed for 70 years. It was really a beloved member of the community. Through the first three decades of the theater, it was very much a first-run movie theater. It was probably a lot higher end than it eventually became. Through the 70s, it was a Pussycat Theater. That didn't stand in Eagle Rock. Eagle Rock was pretty conservative back in the day. So the Pussycat days were very short. But then it reverted back to a first and second run movie theater in the 80s. And 90s was really well attended. It had fallen into pretty significant disrepair. I've heard a lot about the sticky floors, but it was really beloved. And then, as many theaters do, it shuttered around 2000 and was reappropriated as a series of churches, which I think was nice for the members of those churches, but not so great for the neighborhood, which had a massive piece of property that was pretty much closed off to them.
One of the things that was really brilliant is you brought in a lot of community partners. Can you talk a little bit about that strategy to strengthening the brand and reinvigorating?
Sure. When we signed the lease, it was just 4 months before the pandemic hit. Once we signed the lease, there wasn't really anything we could do. We had raised just enough money through individuals who I knew who were very passionate about the theatrical experience and physical media and loved vidyots. And I had deep relationships going back through my previous years as a film programmer in LA. And I knew had the capacity to help and cared. We had just enough to sign that lease. Once the lease was signed, also, I should say our landlords are very devoted to protecting and preserving art spaces in Los Angeles. And they were former Vidyots customers. So they knew exactly who we were. They were very interested in having a women-run business in their building. I have worked in movie theaters for a gazillion years, but I have never run a movie theater. I was really going anywhere I could. And I decided early on that even organizations or companies or individuals I thought of as competitors in this space, I thought the best possible thing I can do is collaborate. We are all in the same ocean and the tides rise all boats. And I knew that we had a very particular angle on this because of the video store. I would never have just simply opened an art house theater, though one was needed on the East Side. I was much more interested in finding revenue streams to support the video store and to support and maintain public access to the video store. And I did pretty much what Patty and Kathy did in the 80s, which is look at the landscape and figure out where the holes were and then take advantage of that. And that turned out to be movie theaters on the East Side of Los Angeles and affordable and equitable art spaces that would really cater to all of us. And those partnerships and all of that outreach, and honestly, the extreme amount of time that it took to pull this together because of the pandemic, gave us the runway to meet more people, to make more friends, to find more people who really cared, and to make sure the community really knew who we were and what we wanted to do. We gained a lot of trust during that time, especially from the very diverse community around us in Eagle Rock and in Northeast LA. And without that collaboration and without that connectivity to the community, this would be a failure.
Who is your demographic? Are people driving in from far away to come see movies there?
As far as the neighborhood, we're all one city. And I've always treated LA like one city. I like going everywhere. We're lucky that we have so many options and so many things to discover. But as far as Eagle Rock goes, I was looking anywhere. I knew had a gap. And we have always had the Los Feliz 3 and the Vista. The Vista is my favorite movie theater in LA next to the Eagle, but I don't live near there. And especially for people who are working really long hours or you're caretaking kids or parents or whoever, hanging around in your neighborhood is a really lovely thing to do. The East Side is thriving with people working in the arts. We're one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the county. And that diversity is not just about culture and race, that expands to economic diversity and a diversity of people working in different fields. We are very family centric. There are a lot of little kids and teenagers living here. And that's who we wanted to engage with. I really wanted to see Vidiots and the Eagle become a place that younger generations were not only invited to, but were really comfortable in and knew, okay, we can come here. This place was meant for us. And the video store is thriving. We've rented over 30,000 movies since June. We've made it affordable. We've made it really comfortable for people to rent and return. We got rid of late fees and things like that. We really have made it appealing to come back to the video store. Part of our fundraising success had to do with the closures of a lot of theaters. Losing ArcLight was devastating for so many of us. I truly hope that the one in Hollywood reopens. But on the day that was announced, our donations went through the roof. We have access to talent and people who can come and make a screening elevated because there's a Q&A or a conversation. There are thriving art house theaters and a few video stores around the country who are not in industry heavy towns, but they've embedded themselves in communities and they make it fun. It's listening to what people want and reacting to it, then putting a very good staff together. We're very lucky. I was gifted the most incredible staff and we're all very aligned in what we want to do at Vidiots. And so it works. It's very hard work. It's exhausting. And the one downside to the nonprofit piece of it is that the fundraising never ends. And there are lots of complexities to running a nonprofit organization. But being able to tap a community for financial support means that they have a stake in it. Even if they give you $5, they've got skin in the game. And especially once you're open, the last thing they want you to do is close.
Have there been any programs or series or anything that went way off the chart that was unexpected? Something that you guys programmed in this past 9-month period?
Sure. We've been really pleasantly surprised that our weekday screenings, especially of repertory titles that are international and genre and really independent, Art House 101, those movies sell out almost every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night. They just sell out and we don't have to have a conversation or a high profile name presenting. We were very lucky. We appealed very strongly to our friends at A24 when Stop Making Sense was re-released. And they incredibly graciously worked with me to bring Talking Head to video for their first screening back in Los Angeles since they had shot the film in the 80s. And having Talking Heads there was mind-blowing for me. It was the mic drop of my career. And we thought after that, well, that was so fun. We need to do it again. And we did. We were sold out in 15 minutes. We just, why stop? Keep going. If people like it, keep giving it to them. So that's been a really wonderful surprise. Let's refill your cup. You have permission to feel joy. You have permission to forget about what's happening outside of these four walls and intake and express and emote. And that has been really wonderful.
Thank you, Maggie McCabe.
And now our friend Robin Pops Jones.
This is called Precious Images in a Precious Place. The beginning is one of the many iconic shots in an iconic film, Casablanca. It begins with Ingrid Bergman softly pleading, play it. Dooley Wilson, the piano player who has been noodling on the keyboard, stops and begins playing as time goes by, as images begin flowing together one by one,
each a new vision from a great film appearing as if in answer to the previous famous shot from the previous great film. And on, with the music changing to fit the overall genre or mood of each section of the cinematic sob trigger that is Chuck Workman's award-winning short film, Precious Images. The film was made to celebrate the anniversary of the Directors Guild of America and won quite a few awards itself. Workman went on to make similar short films that celebrated the Writers Guild of America, the anniversary of the first use of Kodak film by Thomas Edison in the production of motion pictures, and a gazillion montages under different themes for the Oscars. I remember one about kissing that was what you'd expect. Workman has a style with these things. I've mentioned before how much movies infuse my memories. I remember people by who saw what with me and when. First time I ever went to see a movie at River Oaks Theater, it was to see a screening of King of Hearts, the 1966 cult classic anti-war comedy about a soldier desperately trying to find and defuse a bomb in a village during World War I that, unbeknownst to him, has been taken over by lunatics who escaped from a local asylum. My memory is seeing it with my friend Alyssa, her mom, and the fresh organic apple juice bubblers that the theater had for its patrons. I had never been to a theater like that. Old, single-screen movie palace spruced up with a concession stand that featured the juice that I mentioned before, coffee, foreign chocolates like Lindt and Toblerone, and for Philistines like myself, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I remember being charmed by the movie, recognizing the Italian actor Adolfo Celli from the James Bond movie Thunderball. He played the eye-patch-wearing Emilio Largo, Spectre's number two. What do you remember from your life? Unless you're Marilou Henner, you probably don't remember everything. The actress from the sitcom Taxi notoriously remembers every moment of her life, which is a real superpower that some people have. It's a rare condition, having only been recorded in about 100 humans throughout the world. It's called autobiographical memory, and Henner is one of the more superior examples of it. Give her a date, and she can recall everything about it with amazing clarity, which means she must remember everything about making Johnny Dangerously with Joe Piscopo, which feels like a curse as well as a gift. Now, let me ask you this. What do you remember from movies, even movies you love? I would bet you remember specific shots, line of dialogue, pieces of music, actors' reactions, possibly whole sequences, but not the whole film, A to Z, soup to nuts. And I think that works for memory of any kind of art. Feelings, yes. Beat for beat, minute to minute memory. That feels like it would take up too much space. And I think artists know that. Even filmmakers who are wanting to envelop you, immerse you in the world they're creating, they aren't thinking that you're going to itemize every detail in your brain. They want you to dive in and soak up, not collate. So in film, we take away images, shots, etc., that are many poems created to give you the essence that you keep of what you saw, but not to be separate from what you saw. Poetry is a distillation of complex emotions and ideas. What we remember is a small thing that encompasses our feelings and thoughts about the whole experience. And it's different for everyone. For instance, for me, Bogart drinking in his club late at night, slamming his fist on a table to emphasize that of all the gin joints in all of the world, she walks into mine. Ki Hui Kwan in the elevator with his wife, Michelle Yeoh, straightening his posture and removing his glasses like Clark Kent changing into Superman, indicating he is her husband and not at the same time. The melancholic expression on Charles Aznavour's face as he plays the piano and Shoot the Piano Player, representing the present and future he expects for his character based on his dark, sad past. And it works for life, too. Just thinking about River Oaks Theater, I get flashes of the warm yellowish amber at night, walking on the mezzanine to the glass doors that face out on West Gray. Not a sickly yellow, but a warm, sunny yellow, ironically offsetting the darkness of a movie theater. It feels like being welcomed. There was the scent of popcorn, obviously, but mixed with coffee. And then, later, a darker, hotter scent when the espresso cafe was added upstairs. The taste of those butter cakes on consignment from Treebeard's. It is tempting to call River Oaks Theater a gateway drug to the world of cinematic storytelling, but good God, between the programming of the classic double features when I started there and then the brand new art house fair later on, and the whole aesthetic of the place, the feelings, the emotions that these many poems, these precious images bring forth, that's why I wanted to be a part of this podcast. I first saw the short Precious Images at the Houston International Film Festival on opening night in front of whatever the opening film was, maybe the saccharine 84 Charing Cross Road or the silly Michael Caine, Valerie Perrine, Jimmy J.J. Walker comedy, Water. But seeing the short with my friend Jackson was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had in the theater. These little bits of cinema rushing together, wave after wave washing over the audience. It makes me scream sob like that lady who came out of a screening of the Vanessa Redgrave late 80s film Weatherby, triggered by the intense story. She collapsed on the floor at the theater, just wailing, just overwhelmed by the emotions coming up for her. I get like that with great film. My child inevitably leans over and says, "Dad, are you crying? Again?" The things that stick with you, the important things and the emotions that are attached to them, can grab you with a ferocity. I'm always moved by realizing with an incredible, joyful gratitude that whatever I'm seeing didn't have to be that good. They could have coasted. They could have phoned it in. Chuck Workman in Precious Images is working in an almost ecstatic religious fervor. And at River Oaks Theater, they, everybody who worked there for long enough, were not phoning it in or coasting as much as they may have wanted to. The theater didn't have to be that good. And that's what makes it great.
And now a conversation between Michelle Mower and Maureen McNamara, who are currently in production on a documentary about saving our favorite historic art house theater, the River Oaks.
Hey, Michelle.
Well, hello, Maureen.
It's so awesome that we were able to get together today to talk about the new documentary.
It's true. I mean, something we've been working on for a while now. I think, when did we actually start production? We started, technically, I want to say maybe...
We're like an old married couple. <by now. laughs>
When was our first date? Let's see, April, I'm thinking, is when we first, maybe in the sort of seeds of this started.
Maybe. Well, you came to me and said, we're going to kick ourselves. We'll kick ourselves if we don't document it.
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, this is, it's just been an incredible... just story of this community that very quickly rallied to save this historic art house theater. As someone who works in the film industry and is aware of what's happening nationally with regards to our cinemas post-pandemic, especially some of these older art house cinemas, and seeing them being shuttered theater after theater after theater across the country.
Yeah, like gems, not just older theaters. We're talking about special theaters.
Absolutely. And it was just so heartbreaking. And we had rallied back in 2007 to save the River Oaks Theater at one point, and we were successful with that campaign. However, here we are again, 2021, and right back to square one and having to save the River Oaks Theater. And we were in the middle of the pandemic, which made it all the more challenging because back in 2007, we could say, "Oh, everybody go meet out front of the River Oaks Theater. We're going to protest." You know, this time it's like, should we all meet up in person and get a crowd together in the middle of a pandemic? You know,
And even if we do, who's going to be driving by because everybody's at home?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there was a lot of conversations about how to approach this campaign to make it safe but successful. And so I know that there were groups like the River Oaks community, first of all.
Everybody, really. Okay. Everybody wanted to come out and really embrace the theater.
Correct. That's correct. But you had the Rocky Horror Picture Show fans. You had just the neighborhood, the people who love this theater. And we're like, pandemic be damned. We're going out and saving this movie theater. So we rallied. We had some protests out in front of the theater. Maybe not initially as big as the ones that we had back in 2007, but they were still very grassroots, very passion-driven. Let's get out there and make people aware of what's happening. And a lot of this was being done, not really in coordination necessarily, but we were certainly aware of each other with Landmark Theater, who at the time were trying to renegotiate their lease. In fact, they were the ones who alerted us, the community, that there was a potential threat of them not being able to renew their lease and the theater shuttering forever. So I think that's a testament to how special this theater is, that we were so quickly able to get people to not only come together and rally, but to do so in the middle of a pandemic.
Not just the demonstrations, but things on social media, flooding the mayor's office with love letters to the theater and calls to action, getting the press involved, doing social media panels, pulling with filmmakers and important historians and people around not just Houston, but around the country. We did a survey, right, on social media where 166 different zip codes wrote in about how they were passionate about, or people from 166 different zip codes. So that's not just your neighborhood theater. We're talking about people from miles away, and even a few people popped up around the world. But let's talk a little bit more about the production.
I think that we, to your point, we did do some online, we did the Zoom panel that I think was really important in helping engage those communities beyond just Houston. But then once the dust settled on all this, unfortunately, Landmark was unsuccessful in renewing their lease. And at that point, we just didn't know what was going to happen. And I think that once we found out that there was a new tenant who was going to be coming in and potentially remodeling the place and reopening it under, we didn't know at the time, but it would be reopened as a movie theater. I think that's when I first started thinking, okay, if that happens, I'm definitely documenting this because this is rare. It's extraordinarily rare for a historic art house cinema like the River Oaks Theater to shutter and then later reopen again as an art house cinema. And to me, it was just a fascinating story of the sort of the phoenix rising out of the ashes. And I felt like it was just really vital for not just the community in Houston to be a part of this story and to show the special circumstances around this theater, but also the country that were losing their theaters and maybe being a model or inspiration for other communities to rally and save
their playbook, perhaps.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and I hope that that's what we're doing. I think that we are doing that. We've got some incredible interviews that we've collected thus far, and we still have
more. We have a few more to go.
We do.
Okay.
We do.
So, Michelle just interviewed a person who was an usher at the theater when he was much younger, because now he's 95.
Yeah.
And
95 years young.
Yep. 95 years young. So just tell us, just give us a little sneak preview of that.
Sure.
What was your favorite story about?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I should tell that one.
Okay. Don't tell
the
favorite.
I'll tell it, but I'm not sure if it'll make it in the movie. We'll see. So, yes, this last week I had the extraordinary honor to interview a gentleman by the name of Bill Kaiser. And Bill was an usher. He was 13, 14 years old, roughly, when he was an usher at the River Oaks Theater. And he was telling us a lot about what the area around the River Oaks Theater looked like back then. It was very woodsy and rustic-y.
Oaky.
Yes, very River Oaks, you know. There was a river and oaks, I presume. But I guess if I had to say my favorite story was, I don't know if I should be saying this, but I'm going to. So the projectionist back then,
yes,
whose name we are trying to research and find out. But he lived at the River Oaks Theater, basically. He had a room with a bedroom and everything in the back of the projection room. I don't know if you know that, but you know that space behind the projection room upstairs that has two couple of windows?
I'm just going to say that we're keep going. Yes, that's the... It's basically really the stair. It was the stairs
yes.
from the balcony
yes.
up into the projection booth. Yes.
So this projectionist, he stayed back there. And sometimes at night, he would show other films besides.
Oh, I see. I can tell by the way you're raising your yes, eyebrows.
By, yes, exactly. And some of those other films may or may not have starred the manager of the theater.
What? Oh my God.
His name will also
remain nameless. Yes, I mean, this is in the 40s.
This was in the 40s.
My gosh.
Yes. So he was, I guess, an aspiring filmmaker of sorts, but that was my favorite story. I just got to hoot that this.
Yeah.
And that this 13 or 14 year old would have been aware, because I think he came in one night and it was showing and he was like, oh my gosh, there's my boss on this big screen.
That's funny.
So,
okay. Well, yeah, you have to, off mic, you have to tell me the name because there are some stories about projectionists.
I'm sure. Well, of course, back then, he told us the projection room was fireproof.
Yep.
And so he was basically locked in the room.
Nitrate.
Because of the silver nitrate. And that's where he mentioned that he may have invented something that could have influenced or prevented a fire. And so we're researching that now to see if that actually was the case and what he may have invented as a fire retardant in the case of the film exploding.
Yeah, which happened.
Which did happen.
Okay.
So we're in this production. I know we're planning to film through the grand opening at least.
Yep.
We've got quite a few interviews so far, including Mr. Kaiser, and we're hoping that he will come out to the grand reopening. We'll
That'd
see.
That'd be nice.
He'll be available, but see if he's capable.
Yeah.
But we would love to have
Pretty
him
sharp, it sounds like.
Very sharp.
Yeah.
And he's a hoot. He's so funny. But we would love to have him there, as well as anybody else who may have worked at this theater or have a special connection to the theater.
Yeah,
we'd love to see everybody.
Why don't we do a call? Let's do a call for people who worked at the theater to contact us.
Yeah.
We could get people to sign up on social media and let us know through our Friends of River Oaks social media channels.
If you or someone you know worked at the River Oaks Theater, please contact us at Friends of River Oaks Theater.
Now, the documentary is really about the saving of the River Oaks
yes.
Theater and the need to stay engaged in the theater and help save the theater every day by showing up and experiencing it, and not just you, but your kids' kids, and their kids' kids.
And your friends and family and
exactly.
loved ones. And
yeah, for it's generations gonna
be,
to come.
When it reopens, it's going to be a really cool place for date night. I guarantee it.
Well, thank you so much for coming out and spending time chatting with me.
Thank you for being open to my crazy idea of making this documentary.
It's a ride. We're on a ride.
We are.
Together.
It's a fun one.
All right.
Let me put you on to some exciting film events coming up here in Houston, Texas. Wednesday, April 3rd at Heights Beer Garden, For the One Studios and the Houston Cinema Arts Society are hosting a filmmaker mixer. So come mingle with like-minded creatives and build your network. On April 18th at Ulta Arts, the Houston Cinema Arts Society is doing an encore screening of their CineSpace short film competition that's in partnership with NASA, which is really cool short films using NASA archival footage. On Saturday, April 6th, the Aurora Picture Show and Buffalo Bayou Partnership present Nightlight, which is a free annual event featuring video activations on the surfaces of the Buffalo Bayou East waterfront. Super cool, really exciting. You're going to walk a half mile stretch of the Bayou trails and look at site-specific media. It's really beautiful. You're not going to want to miss this uniquely Houston experience. I'm so excited about Moonlight Movies at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. It's going to be an outdoor movie watching experience, like a silent disco style. And there's going to be popcorn and cocktails overlooking the beautiful sculpture garden. The lovely Wizard of Oz, which actually premiered the same year that the River Oaks Theater opened. Labyrinth and Monty Python and the Holy Grail. On Thursday, April 25th, at the Asia Society Texas, Mao's Last Dancer screens, which features our friend on film, Kyle MacLachlan. This film will also feature a special conversation after the screening, so stick around and check it out. Friends of River Oaks Theater celebrates the anniversary of the Heritage Society in the Houston Heritage Park with music, dancing, and Urban Cowboy on April 20th. Also coming up in May is Little Shop of Horrors at the Buffalo Bayou Park, and in June, Apollo 10 and a Half at the Manil. Mark your calendars for the 2024 Houston Palestinian Film Festival at Rice University, May 17th, 18th, and 19th. Wow. Houston has so many amazing films and screening events to offer. Make sure to pay attention to different venues' calendars and different organization calendars. There's so much going on you won't want to miss. And these are just a few of them.
Friends on Film was created by Justice Tirapelli-Jamail, Rachel Valentine Acosta, Maureen McNamara, and Mario Rodriguez. Friends on Film's theme was composed for the podcast by Jeff Walton. This episode was scored by artist and musician Hesher. You can buy and stream his music at www.hescher.bandcamp.com.
Dionysus Imports is a proud sponsor of this episode and the distributor of Kyle MacLachlan's wine label, Pursued by Bear, widely available in wine bars and fine dining establishments.
Friends on Film is funded in part by the City of Houston through Houston Arts Alliance.
At Plains Capital Bank, relationships come first. Customers value their Texas roots, strength, stability, and straightforward approach. Plains Capital Bank's true legacy is the positive effect they have on their greater community. And this sponsorship is an example of how they give back. To learn more, visit plainscapital.com. Thanks to Patrick Brooks, Rhonda Cook, Ian Druk, Kayleen McNamara, Grace Posey, Pedro Salazar, Taylor Smith, Johnny So, Grant Turley, Stephen Wells, Heather Green Warner, Kyle Vaughn, and all of today's guests. If you'd like to become a sponsor or have any questions, please email podcast@friendsriveroakstheater.org. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Friends on Film. We'll see you at the movies.